It helps to know. At the right time. So, so the seven factors of awakening is a theme for today, and the instructions are to know them in various ways. And this, the theme of knowing appears throughout the text. But these seven factors of bodhi, of awakening, you know, what is awakening? It's a kind of a synonym for liberation, freedom. I want to tell you a story. When my early, on my years at, I lived at the Green Gulch Zen Center. It's a Green Gulch Farm Zen Center. It's in part of San Francisco Zen Center, somewhat rural part of it. And there's a, their meditation hall is a very large converted hay barn. And it has a kind of, to me, kind of a special, maybe that's because I meditated in it so long, and it's been set up to be a Zen meditation hall, it kind of feels kind of special to me. It's kind of solemn, sacred, but kind of you enter into it and there's a kind of quiet that settles in, just being there. All those people who meditated all these years, and it's kind of very, you know, it's I've loved sitting there and meditating. And when I first came there, I was told that there's an altar to the Buddha with a Buddha statue on it. And the way it's set up, we were told there's a line from right down the middle of the room by the Buddha, and you don't cross that line. You never cross over in front of the Buddha. And there was space. There was a nice little walkway behind the altar. So if you wanted to go around to the other side, you had to go around the back of the altar and come around and go to the other side. But you would never go across the front. So that was just part of the deal. But what happened was that as I was living there and being in the meditation hall, there were times for cleaning and doing different things, and there were times I walked close to that line, and that line had a force field, and I would feel myself getting close, you know, I can go step back, and there's like a force field or something there, the presence that was there. So that, you know, I didn't think about it much. I knew I wasn't supposed to cross a line, and there was this force field. I was in the back behind the altar one day, up on a little stage, steps you coming down. I don't know what I was doing there, but every once in a while, in the middle of the day, tourists would come and walk around and look at things, and they were in the meditation hall looking around. They didn't know anything about this line. So they were walking around like tourists, still looking and stuff, and they just walked right by the line, and there was no lightning. You know, nothing happened to them. They didn't get electrocuted. And at that moment, I woke up, and I realized there's no force field. I had created a whole kind of idea or image or sense, feeling that I projected onto that line, and that projection onto it was something that I felt I had to be careful for and live with and step back from and not cross. And so it was almost like an entity that my mind had created. There was an imaginary line, but I was told, you know, it's directly from the Buddha's nose out. But the idea that there was something there was just a figment of my imagination, in a sense. And I felt, at that moment, I felt kind of liberated. Like I was freed from this idea, this line, this force field. And my mind kind of lightened up. It kind of got more expansive, more clear. There was a certain clarity of my mind that arose at that moment, a certain kind of delight. That happened. It was a little wonderful moment, you know, after her lived for a long time with this force field, and then. So, how many force fields do you live with? How many figments of the imagination do you create that you solidify and make somehow as a real object, a thing, that then you have to contend with? How much projection do you have on the people around you? It has nothing to do with them, but it's the equivalent of a force field. It's like your idea of who they are. And so you live with that idea more than maybe the person. How many force fields do you have about yourself? How many ideas and fantasies do you build up and create about yourself that then you take as being real, take as being something you have to live with? And then is there something that happens that might, poof, you realize that, it's nothing there. You know, it's just a figment of the imagination. It's not true. And probably most of you have slowly grown out of certain self-concepts that you had when you were younger. You can think back to maybe when you were a teenager and remember some of the self-concepts you struggled with and lived with, and maybe slowly over number of years they kind of faded or were superseded or changed into something else. But imagine if when you were in high school that you had the same experience as I had with that line in the meditation hall. You suddenly saw that the idea you have of yourself was just an idea that vanished. I mean, it did vanish over time, but it was so slow and gradually kind of changed over time. It was wonderful for when I was ordained as a Zen priest, and before that I was a hippie, long hair, and I was content and being that. But having my head shaved and changing my clothes, I could feel something release, some idea of self and who I was, and it was kind of nice to have it gone. When I was 18, somewhere in there, 18, I drove, went to Morocco with some friends, and I'd never been to a non-Western country as an adult. I guess I was an adult, and old enough to be more self-reflective maybe. And as I spent my weeks in Morocco, I noticed after a while a lightening in my mind. Something in my mind lightened up. And I thought it was kind of curious, and I kind of paid my attention to what was going on, trying to figure out. And eventually what I figured out was that the people of Morocco back then still wore, the men especially, wore their yalabas, this traditional kind of robes. And they were wearing clothes and had hairstyles and things that I had no reference point for. Whereas in America, I had reference points for everyone's clothes. You know, and certain clothes told me they were a jock or a businessman or this kind of person, that kind of person, you know. And immediately kind of would categorize them, a fellow hippie. You know, just, you know, my mind would do it. Maybe it was innocent enough. Maybe it was accurate enough in some ways. But when I went to Morocco, I didn't have any concept or categories to put the people into because they were outside of my categories. So I stopped categorizing. And my mind lightened up. Isn't that nice? Liberated. You know? So this idea of creating these force fields or creating these imaginary worlds, projection ideas, and then living in them. Even when they're reasonable ideas, we can still be enslaved by them or limited by the ideas that we live in. So is it possible to become free of what we hold on to, what we get stuck in, the ideas and concepts that we live under? And the answer is yes. And the path for doing this in the Satipatthana Sutta is to know. The primary thing is just know clearly, this is what's happening. This is what's happening. And the how could knowing be so useful? It isn't the knowing in the moment by itself necessarily is useful, but it's the continuity of knowing over time that begins to break down these ideas that we tend to place on our experience. We start knowing the ideas. We start knowing what's actually happening. We start knowing the relationship we have. We start knowing what's happening in the direct physical experience. And this kind of entering into the knowing of the moment begins to break up the hard, attachment to the future, to anticipation, what's about to happen. Sometimes the attachment to what has happened and preoccupation with it. But also some of the hard ways in which we live in concepts in the present, including the concept of self, the way we identify with things. And a big part of this staying in the flow of knowing, it's a little bit hard to keep involved with identifying or myselfing, selfing the whole experience, because knowing in and of itself is not a selfing activity. It is not making a self. It's just recognizing what's here. And it becomes obvious that if you're trying to stay in the present moment with a knowing, that self, self-identity, self-concepts, self-attachment, self-concern, self-consciousness is wind drag. Maybe that's all it is. It's wind drag. It's because if you're it's blocking the river from flowing. It stops, or it's taking the bucket of water out of the river and showing people you have a river, but it's no longer the river when the water is in the bucket. There's something that's, we slow down, we step out of the present moment. We step out of the flow of knowing in order to pick up self. So if we can stay in the flow of knowing, knowing this, knowing this, knowing this, at some point we'll know, oh, there's a self. There's self-concern. We'll know it for a moment, but you can know in such a way that it's just another part of the stream. It's another thing that arises in the moment and passes. And you can see the difference between just knowing and getting involved. Or just knowing and taking up residence in it. Living in it and becoming it. It's just a knowing, just a moment. And you might eventually have the same lightening that I had in Morocco towards yourself, where you no longer live and under the weight of the concepts and ideas that you've inherited from your people around you, that you've taken on, that you've made up, that you've, all these things. One of an interesting exercise I did when I was in college was I was pretty self-conscious, and so I made the exercise of imagining that as I went around campus, imagining that no one could see me, that I was invisible, and that kind of clarified or showed me how much self-preoccupation I had. And in that imagination, like what people are thinking of me, and that I had to be someone for somebody, I had to, do all these ideas of self, and a lot of self-consciousness was in relationship to other people. And when I imagined myself as being invisible, then I could see much more clearly what I was doing, the stories I was making up, the concerns I had, and it helped me to, by seeing it more clearly, it helped free me from some of it. It was kind of a nice, no one sees me, I'm not here, so I can just be. It's kind of like some people are at home, you don't get out of your pajamas because, no one's there to see you. Then who cares? But as soon as someone says they're coming, then and then, it takes a while to get ready, to be presentable. So this waking up out of the contractions we live under, waking up from the limitations of the ideas and the weight of concepts, the weight of self, the weight of attachment, is, I think for me, is an important idea that waking up out of, is waking up in such a way, and that one of the images that they have in Buddhism for this waking up is the lotus that blossoms out of the muddy water. And so the mind wakes up, but we're still in the, you know, rooted in the mud. It's not like we leave the world, but we're kind of above the mud. The lotus blossom blossoms untouched by the mud. So this idea of the something about the clarity of the mind, the openness of the mind, the openness and clarity of knowing that's unrestricted. It's not stuck into anything. It's not caught in anything. Just allows us to be open and fluid to the next arising, to the next event. Leave the meditation hall, and you can leave the meditation hall behind. And you're open and present for what it looks like in the little foyer out there. See the shower poles that are used to hold up the zafus. And then you go past that, you leave that behind, and you open up to the steps that go down, just that steps. And you wonder how many steps you can go down before you could trigger the motion sensor light. And then you go down the steps and see your world of shoes. Just shoes. So, you know, kind of like, every moment is kind of like, you know, this knowing, this light, this, you know, openness, this presence. To be awake to this, to know this, as we, and not to carry things locked with us. So the seven factors of awakening, seven qualities of, or characteristics of an awake mind, or seven states of mind that support the movement towards real liberating, real liberation. And these seven are mindfulness itself, investigation of dhammas, investigation, effort or energy, joy, tranquility, concentration, and equanimity. These are kind of the crown jewels of Buddhist practice. They're kind of beautiful, wonderful qualities when they're strong, and they kind of, I don't know, they, when you really sense the presence inside of you, not because you evoke them and do them, but because they're kind of happening, they're flowing up, they're there. It's like some of the most you know, enjoyable, beautiful things that you'll ever see. It's beautiful qualities of mind. And and there are states of mind that have, you know, you know they're really strong. As practice develops and develops, they become stronger and stronger, because they come along with the knowing. As knowing gets stronger and stronger, like a muscle, they kind of, the seven factors of awakening are kind of part of them. They're kind of characteristics of the clear knowing, the strong knowing, the knowing that's not caught by anything or doesn't have any Velcro attached to it. It just, you know, just the knowing stands out more and more. And this is one of the great aspects of this mindfulness practice. That as the mindfulness or as the knowing or the awareness gets stronger and stronger, the knowing becomes a stronger presence than what we know. The fact of awareness becomes a stronger thing, entity, experience, than what we're aware of. Whereas, you know, in many times in ordinary life, you know, I'm going down to have lunch, and, you know, the most important thing is the lunch that I know. and I'm concerned with knowing the lunch, just checking out what's there, and I'm not some, you know, I'm not self-reflectively knowing that I know. I'm just like, you know, lunch is the most important thing going here on retreat, so I know it. Or I can be continue with the mindfulness, continue with the knowing moment by moment. So I've managed to negotiate out of the hall, down the steps, past the shoes, past the line, and I get to the lunch table, and I just know food. I know the plate. I know I'm hungry. I can know what I prefer. And I'm just there in the knowing, but that knowing then can become such a presence, such a strong feeling or sense, or that it's actually more important than knowing. It feels more satisfying to stay in that knowing than it is what I know about lunch. So which side of the divide do you live in? Do you live in what you know, or do you live in the knowing? And when it's lunch, it's kind of maybe a kind of a petty example, but when it's the thoughts you have are the things you know, the emotions you have are the things you know, where in that divide do you live then? There's a lot of Velcro sometimes with emotions. There's a lot of Velcro with our thoughts. And so people, you know, go on the other divide where what we know is more of a preoccupation than the knowing. But as the knowing gets stronger, the sense of knowing becomes stronger. And as it becomes stronger, nothing has to change. It isn't that we have to fix anything. We don't have to have a better experience. Because the knowing, the strength of the knowing, is independent of what is known. So it's possible to wake up and become free if what you know is unpleasant. There doesn't have to be any Velcro with the unpleasant. It's possible because a knowing can kind of blossom and get stronger. And that's where, you know, if we identify with anything as myself, it would be the knowing. But we're not going to do that because as soon as we identify, it diminishes or contracts or limits the knowing. It's like the... So these seven factors of awakening over time become these factors, these qualities that begin to stand out and highlight as we do mindfulness practice. You know, it's not necessarily going to happen in any particular retreat. But they are qualities that are relatively ordinary. And rather than holding them up as, you know, this, you know, high rarefied mental states that only high spiritual adepts have, it's helpful to appreciate how they exist in some ways in all kinds of situations in life. My favorite example is waking up from a nap. So I don't know how, you know, maybe you wake up from nap differently, but occasionally I'll have a short nap that's really delicious. And it's middle of the day, I'm laying in my bed, so when I wake up, it's still light because it's middle of the day. And sometimes the light is streaming through the window. And I don't have to, excuse me, I don't have to rush off somewhere, so I can just lay there. And in those moments of laying there, I'm content, nothing to do, and I'm just laying there. But because I'm had enough of a nap, I'm alert. And in that contented alertness, the seven factors of awakening are there to some degree. First, I'm aware of what's happening. I'm aware that I'm laying there, and it's the medium of awareness that helps me feel how good this is. I'm aware that I'm laying there, aware of the room, aware of the light. I'm kind of, you know, and actually, I'm more here in the experience than I am preoccupied by the past, the future, things, other places, and something about the poignancy of the room at that particular time, of being there, that seems more kind of vital than, you know, other thoughts and other times, other places. Maybe because I had a nap, you know, just things were settled down. And then I'm laying there, and there's a degree of investigation in the sense. In a sense, the investigation here in the seven factors mostly means to kind of see things distinctly for what they are. Distinctly, to kind of see one thing as being distinct and other things distinct from each other. And so I might look and see there's the curtains coming down. And the curtains are blowing in the wind, the breeze coming in through the windows. And so I'm kind of noticing that there's an effect, and I see the curtains, I see the light coming in. I look around, and suddenly the ceiling gets very interesting. And I notice kind of the pattern of stuff on the ceiling. I'm not investigating in sense of getting down to analyzing the experience. But it's a kind of investigation that distinguishes things so we can see them more clearly for what they are. And that idea of distinguishing, so we can see clearly, is so the knowing can become clearer and clearer. If everything's just a blur, then the knowing can't be so clear either. And so this Dhamma Vichaya, the investigation of Dhammas, have a lot to do with making clear and clearer distinctions. What's happening in the moment? What's here? So I'm laying there after my nap, and I'm just kind of noticing things in my bedroom I hadn't noticed before. The ceiling, and there's a crack, and you know, I look at it, the crack's interesting. Look at the crack, and, you know, the details of the crack, and how wide the crack is, and all these little details that kind of stand out. And then there's a kind of energy there, but it's a kind of wonderful energy that's kind of invisible in the sense that I'm neither too much nor too little, it just is. I'm just there. And then the awareness is just there, the investigation is just there. There's no work involved in the energy. But there certainly has to be energy, but it's just the clarity, it's like the vitality is kind of flowing in a nice way after the nap. And there's a kind of a joy or delight or contentedness to be there. Just everything's good in the world for this moment. It feels good and just here, and nothing to do, nothing to be, nothing to, you know. So there's a kind of a joy, contentment, sense of well-being, and I recognize there's a kind of tranquility. Almost a kind of tranquility that's almost invisible too, because I'm not super calm, I'm not, you know, energized in a excited way, but it's just kind of peaceful, easeful, just there. Nice. And then am I concentrated? Maybe, as I study the crack in the ceiling. I really kind of follow it along and very precise, you know, zero, you know, just right there for it. Or the light's coming through the window and it turns out there's a lot of dust in my room. I didn't know that. I was breathing all this dust. But the light sparkles off the dust and it's kind of like, you know, I'm completely zeroed in, you know. I wish I could be that concentrated when I meditate. And why is the dust more interesting than my breath? But there's a there we are. And then there's equanimity, because I might have thoughts about other things, but that normally would get me excited and arouse some concern or something, but I have the thought comes through and, you know, not now, it's not that interesting. The context of this comfortable, contented feeling just laying there, I'm not for or against it, I'm not reactive to it, it just kind of comes through. And I notice that someone left their dirty socks on the floor or next to the bed, and it wasn't me. And you know, how many times have I done that, and I've talked to them about it, and there it is again. But it just, oh, look, socks. You know, okay, well, they did it again. But the mind doesn't pick it up, doesn't get involved, doesn't react, just like recognizes it once again, but just like this evenness, this balance, not ruffled by it, or the mind doesn't get excited. So I don't know if that spoke to you. You know, you can relate that to yourself, but that's one of my favorite analogies for the seven factors of awakening and how they occur in daily life. I wrote an article once about applying them to driving, believe it or not. And so they kind of operate, and they operate more often than we realize. And there's value in becoming familiar with them to be able to recognize when they're there. Because if we recognize when they're there, they nourish us. They're called a nourishment in Buddhism. They kind of feed us in a good way, and it's good to be nourished. But they also help us to strengthen the knowing. And in the context of seven factors of awakening, it helps the knowing factor get stronger. And the knowing helps the seven factors of awakening come along and grow. And slowly over time they can grow. And as they grow, the mind becomes stiller, quieter. Because when there was that line in the Zendo, in the meditation hall, that is a force field, my mind was working to make the force field. There was an activity of my mind that was making that force field. It was relatively low wattage to have that happen, but it was still an activity of the mind. As these activities of the mind, all this extra stuff that we're doing in our mind, quiet down, the mind becomes calmer, more peaceful, stiller. And it's remarkable how little of our mental activities are necessary to do. It's remarkable how much of our mental activity is repetitive. It's remarkable, I think, for most people. I don't want to say for all of you, because some of you might have a lot of success in thinking. It's, you know, for many of us, it's remarkable what a poor track record we have in figuring things out. At least I do. The amount of time I've thought about things and planned things. And one of the great places I saw it was I used to plan a lot, plan ahead, you know, for the next day, what's going to happen, and plan. I'd have everything just right so that things would turn out right. I'd be a good person. I'd be successful. People would like me or something. A lot of work to plan and organize reality to be just right. It turned out my track record in planning ahead was abysmal, meaning that the future was almost never what I was supposed to be. So my plans were all around the future being a certain way, and then I would know what to do. But I showed up to the future and the meeting was canceled, those people weren't there, I was supposed to make a presentation. There was no time for my presentation. And so I fretted so much about, you know, my presentation and couldn't do it. What happens so often, after a while, I'm kind of slow sometimes. After a while, it dawned on me, I have a poor track record. What if I stop planning, since I'm so poor at it? And so that helped free me up that mental activity of planning. And it's, you know, it was kind of exhausting to do a lot of that planning. So the mental activity of unnecessary thinking, unnecessary preoccupation, can get quieter and more peaceful. And it can be replaced by knowing, just to know in the present moment. Whereas a knowing becomes more of a common phenomenon, more ongoing thing, has life in us, the knowing becomes more like second nature that doesn't really require much effort. It's a lot less effort to know in the present than it is to plan the future. It's a lot less effort to just know what's happening now than it is to review the resentments from the past. It's a lot less mental activity and energy involved in just knowing what's happening than it is preoccupied by our sense of self and self-identity issues and how we want to be seen and how we have to prove ourselves or defend ourselves or apologize for ourselves. So as we practice this knowing and take refuge in it, slowly there's less juice, less feeding of the thinking mind, the anxiety mind, the neurotic mind, or whatever you want to call it. And things get quieter and clearer. And with that calmness or tranquility or calm comes things like sense of well-being, joy, delight. Comes things like awareness, mindfulness. Does come the ability to start making distinctions, to clear this investigation, to really see what this is, what's happening now. Oh, look at that. I thought I was just miserable. But in fact, you know, my shoulders are tight, my stomach is in knots. And the stomach in knots, well, that's just a lot of tightness and pulling. And the tightness and pulling is just right on the surface, right below the belly button. And what a difference it is to kind of begin teasing apart and seeing the distinctions of what the experience is, rather than just living in the idea of misery. Misery can't, you can't enter misery. You can't do much with misery because it's just such an abstraction. The investigation of Dhammas is to go and really kind of see what is actually this experience in the details right now. Looking at the cracks in the ceiling. Looking at the sensation of tightness and pulling. Look at the way that maybe misery also maybe involves deep discouragement. And then, so look at the discouragement. Where does the discouragement, where is that in the body? Oh, discouragement feels like a sinking feeling from my throat down into my, towards my heart. So what is that like? Let's know that. Let's investigate it. So it means let's make distinctions here. Oh, yes. It feels like a sinking and a heaviness, and it gets heavier as it goes down towards closer to my heart. And in fact, as I feel it, it actually feels a little bit like a V that comes to a point. And the point actually feels like really intense pressure. That's a whole different, you know, to see that and make those distinctions. It's not trying to make something different, but it's not living in the abstraction of misery. So this investigation is to kind of know more carefully, know more cleanly. Know. And then with time, there can be equanimity, kind of a balance, just knowing. We don't have to get involved, we don't have to be reactive, just know. There might be concentration. You might, you know, really kind of be really focused and say, I'm going to stay here with this experience and really be with it, really know it, and not let my mind wander off. I'm going to actually settle in there for a while. Really be attentive, really hone in on it. And it can feel like a natural thing to do sometimes, just really be right there, right there. So these seven factors of awakening represent a time when the knowing gets stronger and the preoccupations and attachments begin to lessen. And they become very significant experiences in their own right. They become like, almost like, I don't know if emotion is the right word, but they become almost like a state of, that you can identify with great clarity. There's equanimity. There's tranquility. There's sense of energy or engagement. There's a sense of investigation that's distinct from awareness itself. And as these begin to live in us, they can sometimes feel like not only nourishing, but can feel very healing to have. And some people say when they're strong, it almost feels like a healing current moving through us. And in fact, in the suttas, there are a number of stories where there's a story where a monk gets sick, and the Buddha goes to see the monk, and the monk recites, and the Buddha recites the seven factors of awakening, kind of evoking them or reminding the monk about them. and the monk feels so much better. And somehow evoking them in the moment can, you know, someone who has access to them is good medicine. And then there's a story that the Buddha was sick. Imagine the Buddha sick. And he asked someone to do the same thing for him. And that person came and recited the seven factors of awakening. So knowing what I was going to talk about this today, coming up the steps, I turned down, rather than going to the left in here, I went to the right by the elevator, and there's that quilt that's there. Remember I talked about the bell down below? Well, that quilt was made by a woman named Cheryl Gassner and her friends. And she was a great practitioner, good meditator, who spent a lot of time in the Stanford Hospital being a patient, all kinds of problems, and eventually died there. And I was there when she passed away. And very dear. And one of those visits to when she was in the hospital, because she was a strong meditator, I did a guided meditation for her on the seven factors of awakening. And she was pretty happy with that. That was pretty nice. So they have all kinds of, they're wonderful qualities. And they live in us, in all of us. But they're undeveloped, unrecognized, unappreciated. They're hidden, they're covered over. They are, our distractions distract us from all kinds of things that are really nice about ourselves as well. It's one of the problems with being too distracted is that some of the beautiful qualities that we have inside have no room to show themselves, to be here. So the specific instructions in the Satipatthana Sutta about each of these seven factors of awakening is the same instructions as for the hindrances. Kind of interesting. It's not any different. It says, when one of these factors is present, know that it's present. When one of these factors is not present, know that it's not present. And now if you're going to know when it's not present, every time it's not present, you're going to be really busy. So that's not the point. Just, the point is, if it's been around for a while, then it's nice to do some recognition when it's not there, but not every time it's absent. And this is kind of like the basic knowing practice. To simply know what's there, and sometimes know when it's not there anymore. And to some degree, we're learning to stabilize ourselves in the present moment with what's here. And as we know, it takes a while to stabilize because we wander off in thought and fantasy and come back. So this is the whole process we go through here on retreat. But at some point, we begin to stabilize. Not only are we here and really can really know what's here in a simple way, just know it. But as we settle in more, and as we begin kind of knowing more clearly, and as the investigation of dhammas gets stronger because we start making clearer distinctions of what's here, at some point what we notice is that things arise. Things that have not arisen, because they're not here yet, at some point they appear. And so that happens with the seven factors of awakening. And we notice that they pass away, they disappear. And so noticing the arising and the passing, the arising and the appearance and the disappearance, this is like the most precious of the knowing. It is knowing something, but for the mind to be able to know the moment-to-moment rising and passing of experience, the rising and passing of perception, the rising and passing of knowing itself. It occurs at a time when there's no preoccupation, no movement into past and future thoughts, analysis, just you know, seeing the rising and passing. And then if it's actually this seeing the rising and passing is liberating. It's a kind of, it's like the massage or the flow that begins to soften the grip of the mind to hold on. And at some point we realize that it's not possible to hold on anymore. That when we cling, when we resist, it's a kind of a phenomenal thing that for the most part, when we cling to something, when we resist something, when we're aversive to something, we're really clinging to a thought, an idea, that's completely ephemeral. Turns out, believe it or not, that we cling to something that doesn't really have substantial existence. But it represents substantial existence, so we think we're clinging to real things. But, you know, there's nothing there. You know, you can't cling. So that movement then of clinging sort of thing doesn't make any sense anymore. And the grip that we have on reality and our mind and ourselves and the world and our opinions and our resentments and our begins to soften, let go. And as we let go, the seven factors of awakening get a little stronger. And as we let go, they get a little bit stronger still. The knowing becomes stronger. The knowing lives. And one of the reasons why knowing is such a precious quality, precious thing, is that it's possible to know without it being any work whatsoever. It's possible to know without making any effort to know, to be aware. It's a natural functioning of the mind, a mind that's alert and relaxed will know, will be aware. You don't have to do it. And as we get more settled, and so this is all kind of stage specific, it all has to do with where we are in the practice. But as we get deeper in practice, at some point, the knowing operates on its own, and we're not the doer of it. Or at least it becomes clear and clear that's what's happening. Maybe it's happening more often than we realize. But it's become clearer and clearer, and it becomes clearer and clearer that any being the doer, any way in which we relate it to me, my idea of self, any identification is wind drag. Any identification just diminishes the the vitality, the openness, the subtleness, the preciousness of the moment. It takes us out of the stream rather than kind of resting in it. And the knowing just knows. And it can take a while to learn that, to trust that. To trust that's all we need to do. We can spend a lifetime constantly trying to figure things out, make ourselves safe, find our way forward, get what we want, avoid what we don't want. And that seems like the natural thing to do because it's been there all the time. But to trust that we don't have to do that, that we can just relax, be alert, allow the knowing to be there. That's not us doing it. And so we see the arising, we see the passing of things. Things in that knowing, things appear and disappear, come and they go. And we learn not to cling to it. We learn not to grasp it, to clamp down on it, to resist it. Just be with it. We learn not to make a self out of it. It just is. And then at some point, the instructions are, one knows that these seven factors of awakening are just there. In a nice, natural way. So to be free, to be awake, to be liberated, to know, These are all closely connected ideas. The seven factors of awakening. It's said that they are the greatest form of inner wealth that you can possess, more valuable than any material wealth that you could have. And I suppose the price for having that wealth is to trust your capacity to know, to trust it so fully that you can stay in the flow of knowing, you stay in the way that knowing flows along in the river of the present moment. Trusting, taking some time, even if it's just for a short duration, running the experiment. What happens if you just trust? Resting in the present moment as it unfolds, as it moves, as it arises and passes. Let that be your whole reality. Just seeing, knowing what arises, what passes, the comings and going. In this place that we call now. And in the end, perhaps we'll realize that there are no force fields around what we believe. So you can walk freely everywhere.